This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, signature support from the Mayor President's Office, East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Our leadoff guest is John Maxwell Hamilton, the Hopkins B. Brazil Professor of Journalism at LSU's Manship School, a school where he presided as dean for more than a decade. Longtime journalist, author, and public servant, and he is back in a interesting way with a new book, and he is a prolific writer among many other accomplishments. His latest, The French 75, The Cocktail, and it has become synonymous with many night spots in Louisiana, but it really came into its own at Arno's in New Orleans, and it all started in World War I. And good morning to you, John Hamilton.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to hear your voice. Well, tell us about the French 75. It was a drink that did and still does pack a punch.
Yes, well, it's named after a gun, so it is synonymous with power, that's for sure. It was named after the French 75 millimeter cannon, which was famous in World War I because it is credited with saving Paris when the Germans started their quick march in the first days of the war, hoping to march right into the streets of Paris. After that, the gun was blazing away all over the country during the war and was inspirational to many French people because they saw it as a symbol of hope that they would actually prevail in the war.
Well, it's stayed the course. It is as popular or more so now than before. As you say, it started with a flourish. What do you credit its staying power to?
Well, you know, in the beginning, I think you could say that the drink was a way to drink something that was patriotic. That is to say, you could, when you weren't at the front fighting, or if you were just a citizen at home, you could have a French 75 and you were participating in the war. And in fact, there were all kinds of French 75 memorabilia, what is now memorabilia, but then were artifacts, ranging from lamps that had the French 75 gun on it to pens and cocktail napkins and postcards. Actually, the list goes on and on into the scores of items. The drink then, of course, being one of them. And so the drink, I think, got its initial liftoff simply because it was a patriotic drink. Mind you, there had been drinks with roughly the same kind of ingredients before that. But what made the drink really sick was it had a tremendously evocative name. And so as a result of that, even when people forgot what the guns were about, they thought this was a really sexy drink. And I'll give you one quick example. Well, actually two. As I was Googling around one day, I found in Aurora, Illinois, the French 75 Lounge and Art Gallery. Now, this is very interesting to me because I grew up in Aurora, Illinois. It's a suburb of Chicago. A distant suburb. A few people commuted. It was a city unto itself, but certainly in what is called Chicago land. And right down the street from this lounge, my father had a laundromat. So I knew the street very well. And so I was surprised because, like, believe me, no one when I was a child talked about the French 75. In Aurora, they were drinking the drinks that, you know, John Wayne drank, like Wild Turkey. So I call up the owner and I say, why do you have this bar? And why'd you name it as you did? And he said, well, you know, we really like the name. It's French and we want to be artistic. But he didn't really like the drink that much. I mean, it wasn't his favorite, but it was the name that was the attraction. And then he did what many people do. He invented his own French 75. Which is like others, but not identical.
Okay.
The reason I say that's a two-part story is because that's exactly what happened at Arno's about 25 years ago. they decided they wanted to rename their bar, and they decided to name it the French 75 Bar because it was evocative of New Orleans in the French Quarter. Then they invented a version of the French 75 to go with that. And that version is now a popular one.
877-217-5757. And talk at talklouisiana.org. We will also catch up with John Maxwell Hamilton. Those of us who've known him for years know he goes by Jack, and he is a remarkable man. He was at the World Bank and a global fellow, and now at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a Marine veteran. He had service in Vietnam. But a listener asked, what are the ingredients? I count five of them, Jack, for French 75. Am I right?
Well, there isn't a French 75. There are French 75. So okay. the French 75 that is probably best known is what I would call the Savoy version from the Savoy Hotel in London. And that version has gin, champagne, lime juice, and a little bit of simple syrup. They use actually powdered sugar in their recipe. That's a standard one. The one in Arnaud's is cognac. I sometimes stop. There's so many recipes. Cognac, champagne, sugar, and lime. But the original one that we know of, the first one for which we actually have a recipe, is gin, Calvados, that's apple brandy from France, grenadine, and absinthe. And to my mind, that's the best of all the drinks. Not everyone agrees, of course, but it's a terrific drink, and it's very strong.
Well, the drink is available in many local entities, as I stated, and Jack Hamilton is probably going to bring new interest in French 75, the French 75s, as he calls them. And good for you. It is considered a sophisticated drink. It certainly has some cachet, does it not?
Yeah. The way I like to tell the story is if three people go into a bar and one of them orders a Stinkabus, which was a drink that H.L. Mencken, the bard of Baltimore, always liked, or the phlegm cutter, or the French 75, you have three different drinks. Which of those individuals would you want your daughter to marry? or be a clothes shopper for? And the answer, of course, is the French 75, even if you don't know what's in the drink.
Well, the book is from LSU Press, and it's a staple for events at the World War II Museum, and I see that Matthew Naylor, the president and CEO of the World War II Museum, says the French 75 is a staple at the museum and memorial, at homes and bars across the globe. Jack has done a great job in tracing the origins of the cocktail in many of variations and making it one of the most prominent drinks of the Great War. The book is a fascinating blend of history and cocktail culture, and is sure to appeal to anyone who loves both. So did leaders of the world like Woodrow Wilson in World War I, were they consuming the French 75?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that he was much of a drinker, but I don't know the answer to that question. I can tell you that Harry Truman, as a young artillery officer, was in a French 75 artillery battery. The Americans and British troops use French 75 cannons, and Harry Truman was the officer in charge of one of those units.
Do you recall the first time you had a French 75?
Yeah, I didn't think that much of it, actually. I got it in a bar. It was all right. I got it in a bar in New Orleans, which I'd rather not say right now just because I don't want to be negative. But it wasn't made with any of the instructions I just gave you. It was made with egg whites and some other things. And it was an okay drink, but it didn't have the real personality that these other ones had.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the old days, journalists, writers, media types, the bright lights of our world, they were synonymous with drinking and smoking. Have those days gone away, or do things go in cycles?
Well, cocktails go in cycles. You know, we had a very strong cocktail culture until Prohibition. And although drinking still carried on, after the repeal of Prohibition, cocktail culture waned. It didn't mean that people weren't drinking them, but they weren't drinking the more complicated ones, like the French 75. They might drink, you know, a gin and tonic, or they might have a highball, which is just ice and bourbon. But cocktail culture really doesn't come back until the end of the last century. And the French 75 survived during that time, that's for sure. But it was part of the revival. And so now we do drink more French 75.
Hold tight. We'll be back and we'll talk about journalism with a man who knows the terrain well, Jack Maxwell Hamilton, back after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We are spending a few more minutes with John Maxwell Hamilton. It's a fun book. I encourage anyone who has ever had a French 75 to consume the words of Dean Hamilton, the iconic New Orleans cocktail series, and this from LSU Press featuring the French 75, and the author is our guest, John Maxwell Hamilton. But he is an authority on journalism in America, and I think we know that in the last 9 years since Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, that journalists have had a field day covering Trump, and he has certainly benefited from all the attention he's received, and some say he's even benefited from what might be considered negative stories, and there have been a number of those, and some would say for good reason. But how do you view what's happened in the last 9 years, Dean Hamilton?
With regard to covering Trump?
Yes, and how it's affected journalism as a whole.
Well, I don't think we'll know for sure how it's affected journalism as a whole until we can look back on this period. But I think we can say that covering Trump has proved to be very difficult. And there doesn't seem to be any method that really is satisfactory. You know, I liken Donald Trump to Dennis Rodman. One of the reasons Dennis Rodman was so good as a basketball player was his defense. He hardly scored any points at all, but he was a fabulous defensive player for the Chicago Bulls. And one reason for that was he looked like a windmill when he'd come down the court, ungainly, just really throwing everybody off their stride. And I think Donald Trump is the Dennis Rodman of politics. He makes it very difficult to cover him well, first of all, because he says so many things that are questionable that then you have to be fact-checking him all the time, and then how many stories can you write every day about fact-checking? But also because he doesn't care about the norms of government, in the sense that he has no problem saying if he doesn't win, probably the election wasn't fair. And if he thinks that members of Congress who don't support him are part of the swamp, as he calls them. And he denigrates the FBI and the courts and the military if they don't do what he wants. And so because those guardrails are up, it's hard for journalists to deal with him in a regular way. So one way is just to cover what he says and record all the errors. Another way is to be more aggressive and try to, focus on him in ways that relentlessly to focus on him. And none of them really worked that well. And so I think journalists, we have to look at this period and say journalists haven't done a very good job. You know, I have people who tell me what we have to do is view this election, journalists, as an existential question. And I think there may be something to that, that were Donald Trump to win, it would have lasting negative consequences for us. On the other hand, journalists don't usually cover stories as if they were existential. They just report what happened. And so it's hard to know how to deal with that with Trump. And I think in many cases, for a lot of reasons, Trump being not the only one, a lot of good old-fashioned news organizations that you could rely on to be very careful about using words like lie, now do it all the time. And that's troubling to me. I think the press has done damage to itself during this period. And I think Donald Trump has contributed to that.
Oh, and he's still around. And even if he were to lose this election, it's going to be close. I think that's a given. He probably would start running again for 2028, and I think he would challenge the election. But there have been several stories about audience diminishing, particularly in this realm, on public broadcasting, public radio. And NPR has lost about 15% of its audience since 2020. And there are all kinds of reasons given, but rarely is the reason that I think is most evident. Trump was president in 2020. He's not president now. And as much as we in the media find fault with what he says and what he does, he's good for business, isn't he?
Well, that's right. There was what was called the Trump bump. And so you had subscriptions go up the Washington Post and the New York Times, for example, and other publications because people were concerned about what Trump was going to do and they were paying attention. That's really part of it. I agree. But even though I'm your guest, I feel compelled to say that one of the reasons NPR is losing readers or listeners is because its story selection oftentimes, even to people who are liberals like me, becomes tedious. And so there was a very good piece done on NPR. I love NPR. I used to be, as you know, Jim, a commentator on Marketplace for years.
And I heard you recently on Marketplace, but keep going, yeah. Keep going.
So I'm a believer in it. But I think there was the critique that was leveled a couple of months ago about NPR, I think, is a valid one. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about that because NPR is really the only decent radio program we have out there.
Well, and I think other media have fallen into the Trump trap. And as I stated, he benefits, I think, to a large extent from negative publicity. But you're a year younger than Trump, and I would view you as an American success story. You're from Aurora, Illinois. You got a great education, went to Marquette, Marine in Vietnam. You did your patriotic chore, and I know you saw combat, and then PhD and dean of the school, worked at the World Bank, written several accomplished books. He doesn't read, apparently, very much. He doesn't write. The only book was ghostwritten, the Art of the Deal. And he's not an intellectual, and he got a doctor's excuse to stay out of Vietnam, as did Joe Biden, by the way. How is he an American phenomenon? How have we latched as a people, latched on to him? About 40% of the people would go to hell and back with him.
Right. You know, one of the most sad moments I can remember is when he referred to Senator McCain as a loser. And the idea that he was a prisoner and was tortured and didn't actually go home when he could have because he knew he'd be used for propaganda. And to gratuitously call him a quitter or whatever, I don't remember the exact word anymore, but, you know, I don't want losers like that on my team was his attitude, is outrageous. No Republican that has ever been considered a serious contender for anything would ever have said such a thing. And it's very disrespectful. And that's what I mean about Trump not having the sort of norms we generally put up, the guardrails we put up in political discourse. I'm not letting journalists off the hook here or anyone else. But yes, I think that a moment like that is a dark, dark day in our country.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dean Hamilton. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, Dean. Has journalism's attitude about evangelicals been affected by their seeming devotion toward Trump?
All right. What about that nexus?
Well, that's a really good question. Let's see. Your question is it that the attitudes toward Trump are driven by the fact that evangelicals support him?
Well, Dan, are you still there? Do you want to?
It's the flip. The attitude of journalists towards evangelicals because of their seeming devotion to Trump.
Yeah. Go ahead. I think
we know. Well, I can't speak to every journalist. I will say this. I don't think the press has done a good enough job explaining why good people like Trump.
James and Metairie, will slide you in before the break. Go ahead, James. You're on with Dean Hamilton.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Good morning. One of the reasons Trump is so successful is he's a consummate, clever con man. He makes people laugh. He entertains. They like that. Like the evangelicals, they have a weakness. These people are so gullible. Put them on the gullibility scale. They'll believe anything this guy says. Look at this recent language about the FBI raid at Mar-a-Lago. It's standard procedure. But they're now talking about how Joe Biden wanted to assassinate Donald Trump.
All right. We're about to go to a break, and I think Dean Hamilton will stay for a few more moments. We do need to take a short pause and get his take on James's comments. And, of course, there is more than Donald Trump going on in the world of journalism, but this is an election year, and he's at the forefront. We'll talk more when we return after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and John Maxwell Hamilton going into overtime with us. The book from LSU Press, by the way, is The French 75, and it is a captivating book not only about the drink, but about the times that were in World War I and the times that have come since, and the drink has had staying power, shall we say. That's more than a century ago. And before we hit the break, James and Metairie asked about what he views as gullibility for people who they like... They like the swag from Donald Trump, and some forgive him for any number of sins and alleged sins because they like him. Is that anything that is earth-shattering as far as a revelation?
No. No. I think it's always important for all of us to remember that we always look for information that reaffirms what we think we believe.
That is true. We tend to believe what we want. We see it in sports sports all the time. If we're rooting for a team, the referees can make no correct call and it's against our team. And we're seeing the same thing in politics. It is a fascinating phenomenon.
I think that's true. And I think people who are tend to, when it comes to voting, be on the left, need to ask themselves, are they also guilty of these things?
And one thing I did want to ask you about is a story that was front page last week, as in exactly a week ago, in the New York Times. MSNBC placed a big bet on becoming comfort TV for liberals, and it doubled down. Time slots on the cable network, once devoted to news programming, are occupied by Trump-bashing opinion hosts. The channel has become a landing spot for high-profile alumni of President Biden's administration, like Jen Psaki, who went from hosting White House press briefings to hosting her own show. On Super Tuesday, when producers aired a portion of a live speech by former President Trump, Rachel Maddow chastised her bosses on the air. The moves have been a hit with viewers. MSNBC has leapfrogged past CNN in the ratings and has seen viewership rise over the past year, securing second place in cable news behind Fox. But NBC's MSNBC success has had unintended consequences for the parent company, NBC, an original Big Three broadcaster that still strives to appeal to a mass audience. NBC's traditional political journalists have cycled between rancor and resignation that the cable network's partisanship, a regular target of Donald Trump, will color perceptions of their straight news reporting. Is this a real concern, Dean Hamilton?
Yes, absolutely. No, there's no question about it. I find MSNBC coverage distressing, and the fact that you wouldn't put the president on, or the former president Trump on, because you don't like him is wrong.
Paul downtown, you'll be our final caller for Dean Jack Hamilton. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, but I totally despise the man because of what he is, but he strong-armed himself into a position where evangelicals have to vote for him. They will not, and I will not vote for Biden because morally, ethically, and nothing to say, I mean, Trump isn't moral and ethic, but for what the left stands for, there is no way evangelicals will vote for Biden.
All right, I want to get Dean Hamilton's response. Paul's opinion, I'm sure, is echoed by many in this community and others. Your thoughts, Jack Hamilton?
I respect that that's your point of view, and that's why we have democracy. People decide what they think about candidates. I mean, I have no interest in passing judgment on what another person's view is as to whom they're going to vote for. I'm glad to talk about the issues, but I'm glad you're going to vote.
Well, this idea has been floated on this show, and I think it's actually something worth considering. And Trump really is a man without a home. He's disliked intensely in the place where he grew up in New York. Florida is kind of just a place where he has a place. So if he has a library, and at some point I'm sure he will, can you imagine a century from now, like you've become the foremost Woodrow Wilson scholar, imagine a century from now people coming to whatever library is, wherever it's located for Donald Trump, and trying to find out what made this man tick. I would suggest that LSU try to be home for the Trump Library, John Hamilton.
Well, that's not an issue that I'd be directly involved with, so I'll leave that to
okay.
the administration.
All right. And a listener go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'll say this a story. I've done considerable writing about presidents and writing, and very few write their own books, even historically. And the ones that have tended to write their own books have tended, by the way, not to be very good presidents. The best book ever written by a president is Ulysses Grant's memoirs, and he was, you know, below average in terms of his reputation. But the story I like best is when Ronald Reagan was having his autobiography written by others, he would stop in from time to time. And one day he said, "You know, guys, when you get done with this book, I may even read it."
I think Reagan would like our friend Bob Mann's account of him. He wrote a very nice biography about Ronald Reagan. But a listener makes a good point, and we'll part with this. You know, Woodrow Wilson's been under fire, and we tend to judge historical characters by what's going on in our world at this time. And it's almost impossible to judge somebody who lived a century ago by today's standards. Do we have too much of that, and particularly with President Wilson, number 28 on the honor roll of U.S. presidents?
Well, Wilson's a very difficult problem for historians, especially today. There were times when his idealism was considered a benchmark for how we ought to run foreign policy. Realists in foreign policy now think that's not the case, the Henry Kissingers of the world and even people today. What I guess I would say is that, and for me the problem, maybe I should say this too, for me the problem is I wrote about Woodrow Wilson and government propaganda, because government propaganda in the United States originates with Woodrow Wilson. And I disliked intensely Woodrow Wilson's willingness to block free speech, put people in jail because they were dissidents, things like that. So he comes off poorly in my book for that reason. But you're right that for other sets of issues, it's complicated. He was worse on race than many presidents who had even come before him, than some that came before him, and much worse than would be in any way acceptable today, of course. And that's to his discredit, even in terms of history. He was more racist than other political leaders at the time, by a degree, but he also did some good things. And I think his idea for what the post-World War world should look like was good. He didn't achieve it because he was too rigid and wasn't willing to compromise at the treaty process in Paris. He put together the Federal Reserve. He put in other kinds of laws that were good social laws that protect the weak and the unprotected, and those are good things. But yeah, he has a mixed record. I wouldn't be one of those people who took his name off of a high school. But right now, I probably wouldn't be one of those people who would put his name on a high school. I'd probably just let it stay. But Jim, you're right. It's hard to judge people fairly if you only use the standard of today.
Well, thank you, sir. Congrats on another fine book, The French 75 from John Maxwell Hamilton. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on, Jim.
My pleasure. Thank you. We're joined now by Mark Ballard in Washington. And Washington, of course, is a happening place, but Last year, Mark, as you noted on previous iterations of this program, just over 20 bills were actually passed by Congress last year. They didn't get much done, but they have a lot of rancor that occasionally is interesting. And Robin Dow has suggested, since you're at the forefront of what's happening in the Beltway, let's play it again, Robin, the showdown between AOC and Congressman Crockett, Congresswoman Crockett, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, the pride of suburban Atlanta.
Do you know what we're here for? You know we're here about AOC.
I don't think you know what you're here for.
Well, you're the one talking about. I
think your fake eyelashes are messing up.
No, ain't nothing.
Hold on, hold on.
Order,
Mr. Chairman.
That's beneath even
you. Order of your committee.
Order.
All right.
And I would like to move to take down Ms. Green's words. That is absolutely unacceptable. How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?
Are your feelings hurt?
Move her words down.
Aww.
Oh, girl, baby girl.
Oh, really?
Don't even play,
baby girl.
We are gonna move, and we're gonna take your words down.
I second that motion.
You agree to strike your words?
Yeah.
Okay. Ms. Green agrees to strike her words.
I believe she should apologize. No.
Okay, hold on. Then after Mr. Perry's going to be recognized, then Ms. Green.
I'm not apologizing.
Reserve the right to object.
I am not apologizing.
Now let's go.
I'm just curious, just to better understand your ruling. If someone on this committee then starts talking about somebody's bleach blonde, bad built butch body, that would not be engaging in personalities, correct?
A what now?
Chairman, I make a motion to strike those words.
I don't think that's
Hold
a
on.
Part of it.
All right, Mark, what do you think?
that's the way things are going these days in the U.S. Congress or the U.S. House for sure. It's just. And that's not the only instance of this going on, even though that seems to have been pretty. Pretty stark, but it is not the only instance of them making. They had a fight on the floor last night in which Mr. McGovern from Massachusetts started going over the various criminal indictments against President Trump, and then they argued over whether that was an attack on him personally, which is against the rules, and then they removed it. And for a little while, you think, well they're going to get violent over this.
We'll talk more. And by the way, Congresswoman Crockett is trying to copyright her words about Marjorie Taylor Greene. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Always a pleasure to catch up with Mark Ballard of The Advocate in Picayune, the newspapers of record in Louisiana. He's in the Beltway, and he's covering national and local, meaning state, politics. 877-217-5757. Please be brief in your remarks with Mark. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ballard, yesterday, former Senator Toomey, a Republican, said Trump wants to add 10% minimum tariffs on all imports, increase it until we have a zero trade balance. And, the trade balance is a manifestation of our strong economy. The smooth-hawley tariffs.
All right. Well, Biden is also in favor of tariffs, David.
I'm against that, too, but not to the extent Trump is, I don't think.
But remember, he criticized Trump. We got to be fair here. He criticized Trump,
fair.
And now he hasn't done a damn thing to get rid of those tariffs.
The tariffs, according to the Washington Post, would add $1,700 to the minimum income family, the median income family in America, $1,700.
All right. Well, Mark, David has an issue that is important, and no doubt as far as the economy, really important, but do the American people at this point really give a damn about tariffs?
Well, I don't think that the general public knows really what this is. This is an argument that's in the weeds, and most people don't really follow it. But you did point out, which is accurate, is that that Biden has now has actually thrown up tariffs on some goods coming out of China, and he's basically gotten a lot closer to Trump's position on this issue.
Paul in Opelousas. Hello, Paul. Thank you, David. Paul, you're on with Mark.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning to your guests. Just a quick question. Does Congress resemble the House of Commons more and more? Should we just go to a prime minister where we can just pull him in, pull him out? You know, it's to the point of that. So what do you think? Does it resemble them more and more? Thank you.
It would be harder to go to the prime minister idea that you're discussing, which, by the way, the British Parliament is going to be holding its next election on July the 4th to replace the prime minister, or, you know, that will be part of the fight, is to replace the prime minister. But now I think that the Congress has always kind of been boisterous like this. What we're seeing more is that they've stepped away from being reserved and statesmanlike. That is not what we're seeing anymore. So it may be getting closer to like where it was in the Civil War when they actually had fisticuffs on the floor.
Jason in Jones Creek says, can Mark confirm if Republicans have passed a rule that prevents members of Congress from mentioning former President Trump's criminal trial, unless they say it's a sham trial?
No, it's not a rule. That's not the rule. The rule is that you can't talk personally about somebody on the floor, and that was what was brought up yesterday. They thought that Mr. McGovern from Massachusetts was being too personal in his attacks on Donald Trump, and that was what they implied. But it's not a rule saying, you know, you can't talk about Trump. It's a rule that you can't address personalities.
Well, Trump yesterday got the endorsement of Nikki Haley, his biggest challenger in the primaries, and now in Las Vegas, the odds that are on the board have Trump with a 50% chance of winning the election and Biden at 38%. Trump is a solid favorite inside 24 weeks. He's ahead in all of the battleground states, albeit in every one by fewer than 5 points. But still, he's ahead in Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Nevada. If he wins all of those, he will win all of those states except for North Carolina, went for Joe Biden in 2020. Biden has not been able to crack the Trump wall so far. Can anything happen to change that in 23 and a half weeks?
A lot of stuff can happen between now and then. And, you know, now, will it happen? I don't know. But a lot of things could happen. A lot of things could change. We don't know quite what the impact of these trials are. I mean, we know that Trump's biggest supporters, you know, find energy out of the trials, but that's a minority group. The larger group is going to be the people who are like thinking that they may not want to vote for him if he is convicted.
Well, according to the forecast on Real Clear Politics for the U.S. House right now, Republicans are ahead in 219 districts, and it takes 218 to get a majority, and Democrats 215, so it's close. And that makes the Louisiana race involving Garrett Graves interesting, because he either has to challenge a Democrat in his newly configured 6th district in Cleo Fields, or go after a fellow Republican in Julia Letlow in the 5th. What's your feel about what will happen there?
Well, I don't know. That really is totally up to Garrett Graves and where he decides to run. I think that if he challenges Julia Letlow, remember that about 40% of Letlow's new district is from his old district. So he has a base, and it's the part that's right around Baton Rouge where he has a very strong base. So that's a possibility, but then there are issues about him running against that. Most of the handicappers say that there's not that he can't win in the newly constituted black majority 6th district. But you know, they, if you talk to the local folks, they say, well, there is a possibility. There is a road for him to win. So I this is, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but it'll certainly be interesting to watch over the coming months.
Please be brief. Gretchen in St. Francisville, you're on. Good morning, Gretchen.
Thank you. I would like to say that I think Biden has been an extraordinary president, and I'm very curious as to why the evangelicals would say they would never vote for him. I would love to know. I don't know what they're thinking.
Well, it's abortion primarily. He is a abortion rights person. And in Louisiana, the legislature has made abortion pills, put them on a list of controlled substances, the most heavily controlled substances, and banned them from use in Louisiana, even by mail subscription. So, Mark, this issue in Louisiana apparently plays well and may explain why Donald Trump has run so well here for two times and probably will a third time.
Yeah, I think, though, it's more than just the abortion issue. The evangelical community has been against LGBTQ rights. They have been on the other side of the transgender fights than the Democrats have been. And they have long been very conservative. And I think that their natural home is the Republican Party, particularly after you have the candidates and they're saying, you know, we agree with them. So yes, abortion is a big issue in Louisiana, but there's also these other issues in which the evangelical community agrees with the Republican Party stances on.
Phil in Jefferson. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. I understand that there's going to be a pretty active hurricane season coming up. Are you prepared for your hurricane evacuation plan? I mean, has Washington going to be flooded? I understand that some of the cherry trees were flooded.
Well, I bet you're glad you don't live in the Garden District anymore, because there may be a bad moon rising, but it could go all the way to D.C.
Yeah, well, like when I lived in the Garden District, I lived on high ground in the Garden District, on purpose, by the way.
But there are lots of trees. Lots of trees. Gustav was a mess. Did you get
there
hit?
There were a lot of trees. There were a lot of trees, and we did. We lost part of our roof during Gustav. So, I'm on a higher ground here, too, in D.C. Because, you know, that's a Louisiana thing, right? You start looking at where the water is going to flow. So, but I think that if D.C. got hit by a hurricane, it would cripple the city. They barely can handle snow.
Okay, well, soon and very soon in Louisiana classrooms, we may have the Ten Commandments on display in every one of them. And nothing wrong with the Ten Commandments, but Louisiana's when it comes to the culture wars, we're now leading the pack, Mark.
Yeah, particularly with the abortion pill legislation that came out earlier this week. That was something that has really kind of energized the Democrats in Washington. The White House even had something to say about it. And so, I mean, yes, we're on the front line. We're the tip of the spear in the culture war.
Well, it's always good to hear your insights. We'll be calling again next week, and I'm sure it will be an interesting week as we get closer and closer to Election Day. And next month, the first debate is slated between 81-year-old Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. and soon-to-be 78-year-old Donald John Trump. So, Mark, thank you, sir. Good to talk with you.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. And tomorrow, our guests are expected to be Troy Carter, the congressman from the New Orleans area, and also Mandy Landry, the state representative from New Orleans, who will talk about what's happening in the state legislature. Thank you for listening. Until tomorrow, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe and stay tuned.